Moto America fans, it's time for another episode of Off Track with Carruthers and Bice. You'll laugh, you'll cry, and you may even learn something from this unlikely pair and their special guest. The mic is yours, Paul and Sean.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to this latest edition of Off Track with Carruthers and Bice. I am Bice in Central Ohio, and our communications manager for Moto America is Paul Carruthers, and he is in Southern California. It's noon here on a Wednesday, and Paul and the listeners, you guys may be able to hear in the background, we have this siren that goes off in our little town every noon. So I don't know if you can hear it, but it's going off right now. So anyway, Paul, how are you post Thanksgiving? You got through it okay, huh?
Yeah, I mean, we had some rough issues, obviously, with our little puppy, but I don't need to get into that. But so we're dealing with that a little bit. So that kind of took some of the buzz out of it, but it was still enjoyable. I got to spend some time, obviously, with my family and things like that. So yeah, we kicked off the holiday season, and it was good to get back to work and get going again. But how was yours?
It was good. It was real quiet. I mean, my parents are, you know, like 10 hours away, and it's gotten to the point where it's always tough to make that trip. I think I might've mentioned that last week. So, you know, I made phone calls and stuff like that, but it was pretty quiet for us at home. But did you go and visit your mom and dad?
Yeah, we all met up at my sister's house in San Diego, because that's kind of, they're about an hour away from her, and I'm about 50 minutes away from her. So it works out good as a good meeting point. And my sister's real good about doing all the food and all that stuff. So it was actually nice.
What is it like for Australians to celebrate Thanksgiving, Paul? Tell us what that's like.
I mean, we've been here for so long, it feels like it's just natural now, you know? I don't remember necessarily when I was a kid, but it probably was a bit weird. but you know, the bottom line is you know, it's no matter how you feel about the holiday or how you celebrate the holiday, I think it's just a good holiday. If nothing else, it gets families together and, you know, they can celebrate whatever it is they want to celebrate, but it's just always nice to have families together. And, you know, you hope it's more than once a year, obviously, for a lot of people, but at least it's cool if it even ends up just being the one time.
Yeah. Well, listen, speaking of families, let's talk about this member of our family, Paul. You and I have this rider in our family. We consider him a close friend. I'll let you kind of introduce him, but I'm excited to have him on this week.
Yeah, this one's a little hard for me, to be honest, because, you know, we're not going to beat around the bush. We have Garrett Gerloff with us today, and I struggle with talking to Garrett right now because it's not all good. And I mean, as a journalist, you know, that's okay. But as a friend, I don't really like it. And, you know, this morning when I was going through my notes and looking back at some videos and looking back at some other interviews that Garrett had done with other people, you know, it makes me really feel for him. You know, I think it's bad when you want something so bad, and I could see it when I'd watch his races that he wants something so bad, and then stuff started going bad, and then it just got worse and worse, and I could tell he's just like, what have I done? Like, how am I in this position? But what makes me feel good about the position he's in is that I also know the type of person that Garrett is, mm-hmm. and I think he's the kind of person that can come back from something like this. I also know Garrett's the type of person that feels horrible about everything that happened with his racing. And, you know, obviously there's the big one, which we'll talk about, is the first corner at Assen, where he takes out his teammate. And, you know, I could just see it in his face. He's just like, what the heck? And it's just like, it's not like him. He's never been through something like this. As far as I know, he definitely didn't go through it in Moto America. And I don't know. It's just hard, Sean. Like, it's just difficult, but let's bring Garrett in. And Garrett, first of all, thanks for joining us. And I, you know, you want to talk about this about as much as I do, which is not at all, but unfortunately we have to do it. So why don't we just start with the bad shit? And it was shit. And I know I'm not alone in this country of feeling bad for you, and it was horrible, and we're going to get through it. But, I guess we just start with Asin.
Oh gosh, you're just jumping straight into it, huh?
Well, you know what? Let's get the bad stuff over with, and then we can talk about the cool stuff that did happen and the cool stuff that's going to happen.
Yes, right.
Yeah, all right. All right.
Now, let's just all ask you a question. Obviously, I was watching that race like I watched all your races. You got a great start. I saw you going up the inside, and my initial reaction was, oh, no, 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 just be happy with third right here. And that obviously wasn't the case. You got in a little hot, and you took out the wrong guy or the only guy. You don't want to take out anybody, but that's the last guy you want to take out at that in that situation. How difficult was it to deal with that, and how did you deal with it?
Yeah, no, that was super tough for a lot of reasons, but I think just like there needs to be like more context maybe. Like this year has been really frustrating, not from the beginning necessarily, because I mean testing was going so well. I mean, we were always either leading testing or in the top three at every track we went to with, you know, with all the guys there that I race against. And so that was really, you know, that was really giving me a lot of confidence and giving the team a lot of confidence. And we were feeling really good. Going to the first race at Aragon, first race didn't go very well. I just struggled a lot. And turns out we might have picked the wrong front tire. But then the second day, I felt awesome. Like it felt really good to be up on the podium and be right there behind Alex and Johnny. I had the incident in the second race where, you know, I ended up making contact with Johnny, and that was its own situation. And then that kind of makes you think a little bit I didn't mean to do that. I didn't mean for that to go down. And like, why, you know, why, what did I do wrong? Like, okay, let me try to not do that again. And then right after that, we go straight to Estoril. So, you know, no break in between. And, Estoril had been frustrating because I felt really good, but I just wasn't able to put it all together. I was right there. I remember the first day I got fourth and had to come back a little bit. The second day I was in fourth, right behind the top three, the whole Super Bowl race. And then the second race, just had a freak thing happen to where like the rear end just came up at a totally different time than I've ever had it come up, way closer to the corner. And it just kicked the bike super hard. And I ended up losing control of the bike, like on the second lap and making contact with Rinaldi, which was completely different than the other incidents. But then that just makes you think like, what the hell is going on? Like, you know, like I mean, you guys have been around. I've never made contact with anybody, especially when it comes to somebody going down, you know? And so, yeah, it just makes your head spin. Like, what the hell is going on? I had two qualifyings. One was Misano, where I crashed and didn't set a time and had to start from last. I also had a penalty at Misano, where I had to start from pit lane for the first race. So that weekend was a struggle, just having to come back every single time I got on the track, you know, trying to fight through it and get like a good position. And then going to Asin, the same thing happened. I crashed in qualifying on my first Q tire and had no time set. And so that weekend was just like, you just like throwing your hands up in the air, like, dude, what is happening? Like I had to start from the back at every race. And I think that was like kind of where like that weekend started, just with my hands up in the air, like, dude. And I was able to come back strong in the first race to sixth from last. And then in the second, in the Super Bowl race, which sets the grid for the race too, I was able to work my way up into eighth, which, you know, wasn't as good, but like still I felt good about going from last to eighth. And then I was able to start the second race from eighth position. And I was just like, I just want to, I know, like I was fast all weekend. I think I was in the top two, like every session. And I was like, I know I can do this. And so for sure, like, and after I had the best start I've ever had in my entire life, I went from eighth and was in second place going, you know, into the braking zone for turn one. I just tried to sit up with Toprak, because like, I mean, my intention wasn't to make a pass. It was just to like, you know, I'd already gone from eighth to second. Like I just wanted to sit there because I felt confident that I had speed, but whenever we sat up to break, he's such a strong breaker and has his bike set up to be an amazing breaker. And my riding style is just a bit different. And I just wasn't able to slow the bike down as well as he was. And I had a lot more momentum because I had had an epic start and had gone from eighth to second. And that just carries more momentum than the other guys, you know? So just like a combination of things. And then, you know, I did the best I could to try to stop the bike and to try to, you know, turn in. I turned in over the curb. And I mean, what sucks is like we barely touched. Like it was really subtle, but it just doesn't take a lot, you know. I mean, for sure, after that, it just felt like everything, just like my whole freaking world was falling apart. I was like, I don't know what the hell is going on. I don't know why this keeps happening. Like all I'm trying to do is just do the best that I can. And, you know, and then in that race, I ended up taking a penalty that was wrong. It wasn't the right penalty. Then I had to take the correct penalty, which was going through pit lane and like seeing everybody on pit lane, not happy, wasn't fun. And then I ended up crashing after that. And it was just like, I just like, somebody shoot me, please. Yeah. And that was, probably the lowest point of my career. And in that moment felt like the lowest point of my life for sure.
Hey, Garrett, let me ask you this. So a couple of years ago, this happened with Bobby Fong and Matthew Schultz, where Bobby basically came into a corner and took out Matthew. It was nothing of Matthew's fault. It was a pretty hard collision. It wasn't like your situation, but I've watched a lot of racing over my lifetime, and only recently have I kind of been aware of this idea of people saying I got sucked into the corner, and that's apparently Bobby coming into that downhill. Is that what happened to you? Does that happen to you? And how do you prevent that? Is it something you have to plan for going into a turn?
For sure. Like the faster the bike you're on, the more that effect can happen. And for sure. It does happen. And you just kind of have to adjust for it. Sometimes the bikes that have wings on them, they can actually deflect more air off of you. And when you're in practice and you're doing just like a normal run, whenever you sit up to brake, you have an air brake on you as well as the brakes that you're using, the front and the rear brake. So whenever you're behind somebody, you lose that air brake, which doesn't seem like it would be significant, but you know, it ends up being that way, especially when you have a vacuum of air in between the two guys. And that's what sucks you forward. And I mean, I would say that the incidents that I had didn't have anything to do with that, but because you really, that's more of when you're going at fifth and sixth gear into a braking zone, but still, you know, it's hard to explain. I mean, I was going through everything. I was looking at data. I was trying to figure out like what was going on. And I mean, it's just unfortunate circumstances in the end that ended up happening in succession, which just compounds it and makes it that much worse, you know? So.
Okay, Garrett, we're all humans and we all make mistakes. I know I've made mine. I'm sure Sean's made his and you've obviously made yours. To me, the most difficult part of making a mistake is facing the people that it's hurt the most. In your situation, you handled the Johnny Ray thing. I mean, incredibly. I think if nothing else, you gained fans from that rather than lost any. You handled it like Garrett Gerloff handles things, and he accepted your apology and we sort of moved on from there. The Top Rack thing was a little different. There wasn't a way to make that right because of what had already, the things that had happened previously. Was it difficult to, I can only imagine, but it must have been difficult to even be in the paddock after that incident because of the amount of people that were affected by it and how you probably felt they felt towards you at the time. Is that what you were burdened with?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I to be honest, I didn't really see anybody after that. But like the next weekend, race weekend at Most, I mean, I just wanted to freaking, you know, put my hood up and cinch it close so that, you know, I, I do feel like most of the paddock hasn't looked at me the same, like, and that sucks. I mean, it does suck. I didn't mean for any of that stuff to happen. And like, I'm, you know, it's, yeah, for sure. The more you make the same mistake, the less excuse there is for why it happened. And, you know, that's just kind of where it was, is, you know, you just, the first time you get let off, the second time, you know, it's like, hey, all right, what's going on? And the third time it's, you know, three strikes. So, yeah, it's just really, really, I mean, it still gets at me a lot. Like I hate that happened. It's not me, you know, and, it's not me, but I have no way to prove that it's not me, because, that's all that's happened. So.
All right. I've got one more on this subject, and then we're going to move on to more pleasant topics, but
please.
At the end of the season, I mean, I could just tell, like, the way you described yourself walking around the paddock and wanting your hood on and want that thing zipped up as tight as it could go so nobody could even see you. By the end of the season, that's also how you raced. And it's totally understandable. But you were, it appeared to me from watching that you were going so far over and above not wanting anything like that to happen again, that it just took all the aggression out of your riding, like, completely. And I know your goal, because I've heard you say it before, obviously your goal is to get back to where you were, but a notch below that, or obviously not have the bad luck that you had that caused the things that you did. Because, you know, there's plenty of people that crash motorcycles when they're racing them as hard as they can, but you've had the unfortunate issue of actually having, you know, taking somebody with you, which it's not ordinary. And in this situation, there's a lot of it when I look at it, and it was just bad luck. But is that how those last races felt to you? Were you just trying to get through them without making an incident?
I mean, I'm always given 100%. Like, I'm always doing the best that I can. Like I'll always give 100%, but, yeah, for sure. I didn't want anything else to happen, because at that point you're starting to make people question your career choice and stuff. And, you know, you never know how many strikes you get before it's like, hey, all right, we're done with this, you know? So I just wanted to make sure that, I was clean and safe and did the best I could to, be fast and make, you know, passes that I knew that would be clean and everything. Yeah, that's just what it was. And so I'm glad this year is over. I am happy to have room to make mistakes again, I feel like, because, you know, 2022 is not the same. You don't have the same record as 2021. And so, you know, like I said, I was giving it my all, and I was doing my best to go fast, but, you know, I was trying to make sure that nothing like that happened again, for sure.
You know, Garrett, I got to do a little bit of a preamble leading into this, because I don't know if you're aware of this, but I maybe you are. There was a huge, huge outpouring of support for you within America, and I'm sure within a lot of World Superbike fans. We would hear it at our races. I mean, we talk, you know, the other riders that you've raced against, and even fans, if the subject would come up. And I'm not saying it came up a lot, but when it did, when you were racing on a weekend that we were racing or something, and the subject would come up, and there was huge support for you. I hope you know that. I know that you know that. And I know that doesn't mean as much as how you feel in your own heart about everything. But that the other thing I want to say is, we talked about this in your final year before of Moto America, when you started winning in Superbike. And we even talked about, you know, Cameron's on the verge of winning this championship, and here you are winning races. Well, you talk about team orders or whatever it is, and you have to race. You have to win. That's what you need to do. And we've, as recently as the other day, I did a social media caption about Loris Baz and how he has a take no prisoners attitude. And isn't that cool that, you know, he's so aggressive. Well, it's such a fine line. It just drives me nuts sometimes, because you guys are out there. We all want to see close action. And it's just this fine line when something happens. It's like, well, hey, sorry, I'm trying to win the goddamn race too. I'm sorry, I put God in front of that. I'm trying to win the damn race. I don't want to use the Lord's name in vain. I apologize. I'm getting a little emotional here, Garrett. But I mean,
we all
want to see this. We want our guys to succeed. And it's right up until something like that. It's like, okay, so it happened. There was even a guy that commented on our social media and said, tell those idiot announcers to stop constantly talking about what happened in Assen. I'm sick of it. And I know we're bringing it up on this podcast, but we have a reason for doing it. And it's got to be like, will you guys get over it already? And I know you're not going to form it that way, but isn't this part of what racing is?
I mean, yeah, it's not like I can't see the other side. I get it. I get it. I see what it looks like from an outside perspective also. So, I can't remember what I was going to say. I was going to say something about, the thing that matters is just the outcome, you know. If the outcome is acceptable, then anything goes, you know. If the outcome isn't acceptable, then you have a problem. So, it is a fine line. I've definitely found that out.
Yeah, but I mean, okay, I'm not trying to dredge stuff up, but let's think about how many years it goes. You and JD, and I think JD will admit that was his fault. You guys both went down. The first person you want to beat is your teammate, but you don't want to take your teammate out. So again, fine line. I know Toprak isn't technically your teammate, but part of the same brand and of that same thing. So it's like, God, it's so hard to deal with that. I'm just trying to sympathize with you, you know?
No, I appreciate it. I just didn't have anything, you know. I see it from an outside perspective. I not only do I have the amount of incidents, but also the outcome with each one of them that was negative, you know? So it's like, it's quantity and it's the wrong outcome and it compounds, you know? That's just how it is. And anyway, I'm ready to get past it though and like just focus on next year. And, I feel good. Like I'm with the same team again, luckily. And, we're supposed to have, new material and stuff, which is good. And so, yeah, just try to focus on that and getting back to feeling, 100% on, with everything.
Yeah. So let's talk about that. I mean, I want to point out too, I texted you before Indonesia and I was like, my gosh, you're going to win the independent, the number one independent rider championship. And typical Garrett Gerloff, he didn't want to talk about it before the race because he doesn't want to put a hex on it or anything, and I get that. We've used to do that all the time, and I always said, well, I could say it, just you can't or something. But I mean, let's talk about success. You were the number one independent rider. You were an independent rider this year regardless of what anybody says. So moving into next year, what is the situation? Will you not be an independent rider anymore? You're going to be with the same team. Talk about the dynamic of your team. And if you could also talk about, was your bike the same as Toprak's this year and Loka's this year, or was it different? Will it be the same next year? Tell us about that whole transition, if you would.
Yeah. So it depends. The independent championship depends on the team you're riding for. And because my team isn't labeled as the factory Yamaha team, I'll still be an independent rider for next year. But the GRT team is awesome. And we have a ton of support from Yamaha. And this year I did have the same bike as Toprak, as far as I know. And that should be the same for next year. So that's really nice to have that info and to know that. And, so that gives me a lot of confidence for sure. Anything that guy can do, I feel like I can do. That's the way to look at it. And I've learned a lot for sure this year, just about, different ways to ride the bike. And it's nice having such a variety of riding styles within the Yamaha group. My teammate Koda, the way he rides the bike, Toprak with his special style, and Locatelli with kind of a 600 style mixed in with some other good things that he does while riding the bike. There's a ton of data to go through, which is awesome, and I appreciate the Yamaha group being so open to share that kind of stuff between the factory team and the independent team. And so I feel like we have everything we need to go out and do a good job.
All right. We're done with that crap. I want to talk about the fact that, like, you got the opportunity early in the year to ride a MotoGP bike and you rode it well. And I don't care if people don't remember that anymore. They need to, because everybody knows what a good job you did there. I want you to talk about how cool that opportunity was. And not only that, now looking back at it with Valentino Rossi retiring, you got to be his teammate. You got to race on the same track as him. I mean, not everything in this year was good, obviously, but I mean, if you're going to look at a high point, let's look at that one, because I thought you carried yourself really well. And I think you made a good name for yourself in the MotoGP paddock.
Yeah, that was a really cool experience. It was a really difficult one and frustrating at times, but no, for sure, this year wasn't all bad. It's just hard to not see that being the overcasting shadow on everything. I mean, it was nice. I got a couple podiums this year, maybe three, and that was, you know, that was nice. And the MotoGP thing was really cool. It was really last minute again. I don't like it being last minute. I wish I had a bit more heads up, but I didn't even have I didn't even know it was going to happen until I think Monday, the week of the race. Or Tuesday maybe, and everybody had to rush to get things sorted for it. But it was really, I really appreciated getting the call again. And to get back on a GP bike was a really cool experience. It was interesting because when I did it last year, I only had one day, only two sessions. One was full rain and the other session was half wet, half dry with slick tires. And so like, I kind of had like a rough idea, but not like a full on experience just because it wasn't full dry. But the bike was amazing. And it was the 2020 Yamaha. When I went to Assen, I had the 2019 bike, 2019 spec. And it was pretty cool to experience just how different the bike was from year to year. They really do a lot of development on those things. And they change, it seems like, quite a bit every year to try to keep up with everybody. And so, you know, the 2019 had some interesting characteristics. It was really nice to work with Ramon, the crew chief, and to work with the whole Petronas team. And I mean, it was a really great group of guys. It was a bit frustrating just because the bike is so different from a situation like last year where it was full wet or like half wet, half dry to full dry. And that really like made the differences between the 2019 and the 2020 bikes stand out a lot. I really was lacking stability a ton in some of the fast sections. So much so that I almost high sided a couple of times on the fastest parts of the track just from violent instability, and was trying to look at data and trying to figure out like how I could settle the bike down. But I saw everybody that was on the 2021 bikes, they were doing something different. They were all doing something different to try to increase stability, and all of them were getting good results from it. And I tried to do every one of the things they were doing, and I couldn't get the stability to get any better. And at a track like that, where a lot of time is made in the fast sections, it was just really holding me back, I felt like. And Ramon did an awesome job trying to do everything he could to help me out, to get the bike sorted, to improve stability, which we did a lot, but just was still pretty violent. And so made the weekend a bit difficult, but it was just a really nice experience to be there. And I mean, for sure, I know that I could do better than what I did if I just had a bit more time to figure that stability thing out and just to learn the bike a bit more. But like we did have a couple good sessions where we were, I think it was like 1.3 seconds off the fastest guy, which, you know, now in MotoGP is you're way in the back with that kind of gap where, you know, 10 years ago, if you were a second off, you were in 10th place, you know? Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it's just amazing how competitive that class is now and how close everything is and all the development that all the teams are doing. And it was a really, really cool experience, especially to get through the whole weekend and actually line up on the grid and do the race. Just trying to figure out the start device system is like a 6-step process, and like trying to remember that, you know, in practice and stuff, trying to remember my practice start procedure. And I remember like one of the first times I tried it, I ended up stalling the bike on accident and Jack Miller bump started me luckily. Oh, so, wow. Yeah, it was a cool weekend, but damn it. I know I could do better than what I did. And that does piss me off looking at the results.
Hey Garrett, do you, you've seen that clip that Susie Perry did with Valentino Rossi, didn't you? Where she takes him.
Yeah.
So yeah. I love the end. I'll just tell the story. Most of the fans probably know about that, but she takes him through this gallery of photos and gets down to the end, and she's got a bunch of, I think it's names of people. And she asks, which one of these riders have you not beat? And it took Valley a little while. And he's looking, he goes, and I loved in his Italian accent when he said, Garrett Gerloff, and he stuck his up. It was so good. So that's something I'm never going to forget. You're one rider you never beat. So
I know that is insane. I had no idea. I was watching BT Sport coverage that I think it was Silverstone or something, whenever they did that segment. And I was watching BT Sport and they took him in, yeah, a big room with plaques of, you know, all the riders he had competed against in his 26 years or something of riding. And then they got to the question like, oh, like there's one person in this room on these plaques that you haven't beat. And he was like, yeah, I made a couple guesses and they were wrong. And then she was like, oh, I'll give you a hint. It was this year. And I was like, wait a second. Like, wait, I was thinking back, like, he didn't beat me technically, I guess. It was a technicality, but he didn't beat me. And then, he made like one guess and another one. And said my name. And I was like, no freaking way. Like, are you serious? Like one guy, I mean, it was a total technicality, him crashing out. He was in front of me for sure whenever he crashed, but that is pretty crazy. And now he's retired and everything. And that is crazy. I'll definitely put that on my gravestone for sure.
Yeah, your gravestone can be, this guy kicked Valentino Rossi's ass.
No. Crazy.
The thing I love the most about it is not only the stat, but the fact that Valentino was aware of it. He actually said it. It wasn't like Susie had to give it to him. I mean, he'd actually pondered it and he was like, oh, Garrett Girl, it was like so good.
I'm sure he was thinking like WTF, like, yeah. Yeah. I'm sure. I honestly thought that I might have a chance to ride a GP bike again before the end of the year. I thought it might happen because just so that he could beat me. I wasn't thinking that it couldn't happen. I was like, maybe I'll have another shot just so that I can, you know, get beat. But anyway, it didn't happen. But he's such an awesome guy, like a really, really nice guy. When I was at Assen, he was the room across from me, his changing room and stuff. And I ended up asking him like, hey, you know, have you been having these stability problems? You know, like what's going on? And he talked to me for a bit saying like, oh yeah, you know, but the 2019 bike has that issue more, and, you know, maybe try this or try to do this. And yeah, it was super helpful and super, super nice. And, wow. I'm really, a lot bigger fan of him than I was, even though I was already a big fan.
That's so cool. Hey, so we're going to do a little fun thing here. We did some social media posts to announce that we were going to talk to you, and we got some questions from fans, and we want to go down through some of these. Some of them are going to be quick, like, you know, we answer them quick, so we'll go through them. Some of the questions, obviously, we've already asked. A lot of fans did ask that same question or things related to that, so we're not going to revisit that at all. But ironically, the first one that came up on Instagram came from Rocco Landers, and he asks, what's your favorite track on the World Superbike calendar?
Oh, that's a good question.
They all Assen.
No, I really like that track. I swear, that track was awesome. And it was a lot better on a superbike than a GP bike, I can tell you that.
I bet.
I mean, we go to so many different places. You know what track was that I really, really enjoyed was Mandalika in Indonesia. That track honestly was amazing. We were the first like championship or one of the first races on that surface. And track had a ton of grip and really gave everybody a lot of confidence, I feel like. But I mean, it's hard to narrow it down. I would say I'm not a big fan of Aragon. That's probably, I'll put that on the list of like maybe not my favorite place. But
I really enjoyed Catalunya, Mandalika, like I said. Aston was an amazing place to go, especially with all the history and everything. What else? They do such a good job of making their tracks so, you know, pristine. The facilities, the asphalt, the safety of the track, the runoff and everything. It's really like, it's really a treat to get to ride at every one of them, honestly.
So the next one here comes from somebody named Three Balls McFalls. So that's pretty awesome. But he actually is asking a question that I wanted to ask you, and it relates to, you remember a few years ago when Cameron went over and raced that one World Superbike event at Donington. And I remember the first thing he said was the bike is so, it sprung so soft. And so this person says, how different is the World Superbike R1 than the Moto America R1? I mean, do you remember, can you still relate to the differences? Can you remember the first time you got on the bike and did it feel like the bike you knew or something totally different?
I felt completely different, completely different. I mean, the bike that we were riding in the US was an awesome bike, but you could really tell how much attention to every detail they pay in Europe. Just the bike felt very refined, and just the way that when you would pick up the throttle, how the power would come in, you can see the amount of hours that they spend on research and development for every part on the bike. And it definitely noticed. And I mean, it's because they have to. The competition is so strong over there. I mean, every manufacturer is doing as much research and development as they can in, you know, every day. And so, yeah, the bike really was amazing. It took me a while to get used to the tires, but the tires are amazing also. You know, the brakes were better brakes. You know, it's just a full super bike, and definitely big differences between the two of them. There was a couple of things that I had to work on for sure. When I was in the US, like this is one example, I was in the US, I was basically just using one brake all the time. I was just, like a one finger breaker. Every time that I would try to use two fingers, I would feel like I would be using too much brake power and would kind of overload the front tire and sometimes have it like lock and whatnot. When I first went to Europe, I was doing the same thing, just using like one finger to brake, but you just can't get enough power by doing that. The front tire has a ton of grip, and you can see obviously by the, like when you watch Top Rack ride the bike, I mean, you can really hammer the brakes. And so it took me a long time to actually figure that out, where the limit was and how much brake pressure you can apply. And that's just like a combination between their chassis development, the different suspension, different tires, different brakes. And it really makes the bike feel familiar. It's still an R1, but you can tell it's quite a bit different at the same time.
So here's a good one. Blackbeard 7 asks, let me help with this. So we're talking from Wira to AMA Pro Racing Super Sport early on, to Daytona Sport Bike, to Moto America Super Sport, to Superbike, to World Superbike. This guy's asking, throughout your racing career so far, what jump between levels, organizations has been the toughest learning curve for you?
For sure was going from the US to Europe. It's like, just everybody over here has raced their whole life, and they've raced against each other, and they just bounce off each other, improving every time. You know, it's like the level of competition here is so high, and it's because like there's such limited space for riders. You know, there's only so many spots, and you have all of these different countries that are pushing their rider and pushing their championship to try to get the most competition to, you know, get one of their guys into the world championship. And yeah, it is cutthroat for sure. And the bikes are also on a really, really high level. And so when you have that combination of the bikes being at a really high level and the riders also being at a really high level, it just makes it, you jump in the deep end for sure. So, from the US to World Superbike, I would say was the biggest jump.
So Caleb France 1 asks, and I think this is more about paddock life, but it relates to what you just said. What's the biggest difference between the Moto America paddock and the World Superbike paddock?
There is quite a big difference, I would say. I mean, for me, Moto America feels like home. You know, I know everybody. I have known everybody because a lot of the guys that I raced against in Moto America, and even the people that I worked with in Moto America, came up from like the WIRA championship, like the amateur championship. So you've been racing with the same guys your whole life, and you just feel comfortable with everything. And, you know, there's a lot of familiarity with everything. You're racing on some of the same tracks, most of the same tracks and everything. Going over to Europe, I mean, it's a group of people that are from all over the world. And so maybe there's less like kind of connection there just in general, like throughout the paddock. I feel like, you know, it is cutthroat, and there is quite a bit of money on the line, and there's a lot of money being spent on everything. So there's that feeling of, hey, this is serious, you know. I mean, it was serious in the US also, but you know, it just feels like another step in, hey, this is serious, you know. We're not here to play games. We're here to do our job and you know, make sure that this is worth it for our sponsors and for our manufacturer. And so there's that difference. And, you know, all the riders, I feel the pressure of knowing that there's so many guys behind them that want that spot, and they're going to do everything they can to try to get that spot. So I think everybody kind of looks at each other a bit skeptically, let's say. And I'd say there's a bit of that, a lot more of that for sure, where you kind of feel like somebody will be nice to you in person, but there's that skepticism of like, I don't know if I should trust you or not. So it's definitely a different vibe, but that's the normal, that's just how things progress, you know, in general. You know, you go from one job that's more low key, you're not getting paid as much, and then you start climbing the corporate ladder, and it's the same thing that happens in every time, no matter what job you have, that kind of thing.
So here's a fun one. Nick Usselman asks, what's the best meal/food you've discovered traveling in Europe?
Oh, Italy by far has the best food. I mean, that's what everybody says, but it's true. I mean, you can go to like a little pizza place down by the coast, and they just have the best, the most epic pizza you've ever had for like €6. It's just, it's awesome. The pasta, everything tastes so fresh. For sure, the food in Europe just is, to me, like on another level. Everything tastes like it came from a farm that was less than an hour away. And like everything, it's really weird. Like I'll say this, it's really weird. I'll go to Europe and I will eat maybe like, I won't eat as strict as I do in the US. I'll eat a bit more relaxed. But just, there's so much less processed food over there. Everything is something that they make handmade. They'll use like a bit less sugar and stuff, like refined sugar in their food and everything. And so I'll eat a lot, like I'll eat a lot of calories, but I come back here and I get on the scale and I've lost weight, like a lot of weight. And then I'll be here being a bit more strict with everything that I eat. And I'll end up going back to Europe having gained 5 pounds every time. It's happened every time. And I still haven't put my finger on why, but it really makes me question the quality of food that we have here in the US. And I think it's just because everything you eat, like it's either in a box that was made in a factory somewhere here, or, you know, everything's outsourced. So like you look at produce and stuff, it all comes from a different country. You look at meat is mostly the same way, and fish, same kind of thing. I don't know. It's interesting. It's really interesting. But I'm a big fan of food in Europe.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. And Paul can tell us about this when he grew up and was going around the tracks in Europe. I mean, they used to say back when Kenny Roberts raced, you know, there was always a concern when you were over there if you could get the right food or good food or whatever. And it's interesting, Garrett, to hear you say that it seems pretty easy for you and there's actually stuff that you like and enjoy. Paul, do you remember, was it a situation where it was tough to figure out what to eat over there when you were growing up?
No, I agree 100% with Garrett. I mean, the food over there is awesome. And, you know, when I was there, we were in motorhomes and stuff. And obviously, you know, my mom was doing cooking and things like that. But like he says, the ingredients over there are so much better. And it's just old school. And yeah, you really can't beat the food. I mean, I think those stories start with like people that especially back then. I mean, now if you wanted a stupid McDonald's, you could get one over there. But when we were there, that wasn't the case. So I think it was always the joke of like, oh, the Americans can't find a McDonald's kind of a thing. But I mean, if you're eating McDonald's in Europe, you've got other issues.
Hey, I have gone to McDonald's over there. Hey, it's pricey. It's expensive. Like I'll get, I don't know, something, you know, a hamburger and fries and a drink and maybe like a coffee at a McDonald's there. It's like 15 euros, which is like $18. It's crazy. But like you can tell that, like I would say for sure the quality of McDonald's over there is higher than the quality.
It's funny.
It's super funny. But I don't have a problem over there. I'm a big foodie too. Like I love all kinds of food. And so you could drop me anywhere in the world and I'll find something that I really like that's local.
I always laugh, Paul. This was years ago. I had to get hold of Garrett about something, so I call him up and I could hear like in the background wheels or something rolling around. I go, "What are you doing?" He goes, "Oh, I'm shopping for food." And I said, "Oh, you do your own grocery shopping?" He goes, "I have to. If I don't get my own food, my mom's not going to cook it for me." So Garrett's always been kind of involved in food preparation in some way.
While ago, that was when I was like 16, not like last year.
No, it was a long time ago, but I'm saying you were involved in the process of choosing what you were going to eat, even for, you know, the right food back then. It's cool that you've been a foodie for a long time. It sounds like.
My mom has always been really big into nutrition from when I was a kid, and so like it kind of rubbed off on me a lot, and it really does interest me, just like how the food we eat is the fuel that our body burns, you know? And I've always been interested in different, how different foods or, you know, supplements or whatnot affects how body works. So I'm definitely interested by that subject.
Well, let's change it up for just a little bit here. So Daniel Shattuck asks, and I think we've touched on this a little bit, and this is not critical of anything in Moto America or where we go, but he's asking, how is the track quality of the World Superbike tracks versus Moto America tracks? You kind of touched on a little bit, but is every track over there that you go to just absolutely smooth as a billiard table? I mean, what's the deal?
They're all really, really good. The few exceptions I would say are Navarra. That place was like a motocross track. It was so bumpy, but still had a lot of grip, surprisingly. And then Most into the Czech Republic was really good, except for the first two corners. The first two corners looked like they hadn't been repaved in 30 years, but the rest of the track had new pavement around most of it, you know, and that was butter smooth and a ton of grip. I mean, the difference, I think, is that a lot of the tracks over in Europe are subsidized by the country, you know, so that there's a lot of money that they can use to build a racetrack wherever they want and to maintain it. Or like a lot of tracks over here are privately owned. And so, you know, unless people are coming and using the facility and or renting the track out, there's just, there's probably not as much money floating around to make things as top notch as they are in Europe. So I would say just for that fact, like, yeah, the tracks over there, I would say are better, but it's just because they just have so much more resources at their fingertips, you know? The tracks over here, there's definitely tracks over here that I really, really like. Pittsburgh was awesome. That place is a really cool layout, has had a lot of grip and the surface was nice. When we went to Utah, Miller Motorsports Park, that place was awesome. I mean, we go to Laguna. There's a ton of tracks in the US that are really high quality, and Barber, another one. They have it easier over there, I would say.
This one, I'm going to change it up a little bit, and I'm going to put a kind of a couple questions together. And one of them was asked by Tammy Smith, who Garrett, you probably know, is Cameron Beaubier's soon to be mother-in-law. So she asked any plans for a possible GP ride, but let me combine that because somebody else said, you know, if the top positions, Top Rack and Loca and those guys have those full on factory rides wrapped up in World Superbike, would you consider a different team, a different brand? And even the same way, if you were offered a MotoGP ride on a different brand of bike, how would you approach that? And it's tricky for you because for people I think people mostly know this, but man, you've been with Yamaha forever and ever. I mean, 2011, I think, and even before that, because you were racing in an R6 back in Weiris. So it's been a long time that you've been representing the Yamaha brand. And I know it's strong in your heart, but would an opportunity possibly change that for you?
Yeah, it is crazy to see how long I've been with Yamaha. It was 2011 was the first year that I started riding in R6. And that feels like forever ago, but I haven't known anything different since then. And I really like the Yamaha philosophy, just kind of like the family philosophy, because I have felt that even when I was, you know, when Yamaha USA was helping me try to find an opportunity in Yamaha Europe, just that kind of connection of like, hey, you know, this guy, we're with this guy is like one of ours, and we would like you to give him a shot over there. And for Yamaha Europe to feel like they can trust Yamaha USA, and like that whole family dynamic is awesome. And everybody that I've worked with, you know, on 600s, superbikes over here in the US, and you know, the team that I'm with right now, and also the higher ups at Yamaha and Yamaha Europe have been really, really good to me. And so I would love to stay with Yamaha as long as possible. There's no plan for a GP ride at the minute. My goal next year is to do the best that I can in World Superbike. Like I said, I have another contract for a year. So, we'll do the best that I can, and then we'll just kind of have to go from there. I hope to be able to do a lot of things that I know I can accomplish. And I really hope to get some good results and kind of, you know, prove to myself where I think I can be, and maybe prove to or show to Yamaha that maybe they should give me a shot in the GP paddock possibly. I mean, I would love to go to MotoGP. That has always been my dream and my goal, and you know, I still hold that dream now. So that's we'll just see how it goes, but I would definitely like to be with Yamaha for as long as possible. For just how well they've treated me.
All right, we're going to let you go here in a minute, but just some personal questions. You lived in Andorra. Is that going to change? Are you going to go back there during the off season at all? Are you going to plan on staying there again next year, or is there a move in the works?
Yeah, no, that's a good question. I love Andorra. I'm not there right now. I'm here in Texas, just for the holidays and stuff. But Andorra, I love that place. It's such like, it's so different from the countries that are around it. So for those of y'all who don't know, Andorra is this small country that's maybe like 50 square miles big. It's in between Spain and France in the mountains, like in the mountain area. And it's just awesome. It's really, they have a lot of development there. There's a lot of really cool places to go. There's ski resorts everywhere. And in the summer, they have those same ski resorts become like mountain bike downhill sections, and they have, I mean, it's probably the cycling capital of Europe. Every day that I get up and drive somewhere, I see a cycling team with the safety car behind them going somewhere for training and stuff. It's really cool. It's like everybody's so outdoorsy, like everybody's always outside. The only downside is that it's freaking cold. Like right now, I've seen there's an Andorra Lovers Instagram page, and it's snowing and like 15 degrees outside right now. So that's the only negative. But I love snowboarding and stuff. And with my trainer, Aleish, we've actually been doing some like cross-country skiing, which I hated at first, to be honest, but have grown to really like it. So that's a good like little training thing. And I'm also a member of a gym there that has like an indoor lap pool. And I've been doing like some swimming stuff, and I really, really love it there. And I'd swear like 75% of World Superbike paddock and the MotoGP paddock lives in Andorra. So, I mean, I live a mile or less away from guys like Jack Miller and Josh Hook and others, you know. It's I feel like I'm around a lot of guys that are good to train with. John McPhee is another one. And also Brad Binder and his brother Darren Binder are right there in the same area. So, no, it's cool. I feel like they're always getting out and doing something, and I get to tag along sometimes, and I really, really like it there. So, no move in the works right now. I'm gonna stay there for a bit.
One last question. How did you get to run into Cameron Bobier at all?
Yeah, a little bit. I showed up one time at his apartment down by the beach and close to Barcelona, and super nice down there. And that was probably at the beginning of this year, 2021. And yeah, I was able to hang out a bit and talk and stuff. And I've texted him a little bit this year too. It's really awesome to see how he's been riding, and it was cool to see him at COTA, you know, be right there and qualifying well and racing for, you know, top five, top three. And that class looks just so cutthroat. And it just seems so hard to try to figure everything out and to stand out. It's just really hard to stand out. So, I'll see him here soon. And his wedding's coming up. I'm going to be heading out there. Sean, I know you're going. Paul, are you
going too?
Yeah, awesome. I'll be there.
Reunion.
Yeah, it'll be get the boys back together.
Yeah, right. We'll be looking out for that answer pick. that'll be really good. Hadn't seen him for a second, so that'll be good. Haven't seen you guys for a long time, so that'll be really good. And it's cool to see Sean. I saw Sean tested and he was riding really good, and I think he's gonna be working with my trainer next year also. Sean Dillon Kelly is gonna be working with Aleix, and so yeah, I'm sure I'll see him a lot next year. And yeah, it's looking really really cool.
Hey Paul, real quick, I'm sorry, I got to throw in a transition. He mentioned Sean Dillon Kelly. I wanted to ask about this earlier, but Garrett, since you brought it up, I know we're over time here, but do you think Paul and I have been talking about this a fair amount? Do you think that Sean's transition in Moto2 is going to be easier for him than it was for Cameron, just because Cameron's had to kind of forget the superbike? And for your point, you didn't have to necessarily, although the bike's quite different. You know, is Sean going to go better, I guess, is what I'm trying to say.
Oh, I have no idea about going better or not, you know, but I would say that coming from a 600 to basically a 600 is more of a direct transfer than going from a superbike for 5 years and learning that as much as you can and really adapting to your style to that kind of bike and then going backwards to a smaller bike. I would say that is just going like a side move basically. But I know Sean's like a really, really good rider and he looks hungry. So I'm sure he's going to give it everything he's got to figure it out as quick as he can. And, you know, I'm sure they can work off each other too and each other's data and try to figure out what one's doing better than the other one. And you know, I think that's it's cool that the American racing team will be, you know, American, both riders, and I'm sure they'll be helping each other trying to move up the field.
Yeah, very cool. Anyway, thanks for
I'm cutting you two off. Hey, Gary, thanks for joining us and thanks for speaking so openly about difficult subjects. They're difficult for me to talk about. I can only imagine what they're difficult for you to talk about. So we appreciate that and our listeners appreciate it. And I bet you're going to be a happy boy when the champagne pops for the start of 2022 and you can erase 2021 from your memory banks and get started with a fresh start.
Oh yeah. No, I mean, there's no point in trying to erase it. I mean, it's just part of life. You know, you learn from your mistakes, you do your best to learn from your mistakes and it just helps you in your walk, you know? And so, I'll try to learn as much as I can from what happened and try to improve from there. And I mean, I've already been busting my butt trying to, you know, do as much training as I can. And I'm already looking to 2022 a lot. And, you know, I know we can do something good. So yeah, I'm focused and ready to get back on the track as soon as I can, as soon as possible, and go from there.
All right, Sean, you guys have a good week.
Yeah, appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.